visibly shakes herself. But of course the well was sealed after we left. The builders will say that. Of course, I agree easily. When the police find them. When they find them, she echoes. She is silent for a moment, then cocks her head and looks at me piercingly. You think I'm being played? I don't know, I admit reluctantly but honestly. I remember the sudden stillness in Mordaunt's face when he saw Lara again. I think that he would very much like to do whatever he told you he'd like to do to you. Now I'm the one blushing. But whatever you said about the six of us, he can't unhear it. You weren't being interviewed, but he'll use it if it helps him. She looks at me thoughtfully but doesn't say anything. I don't know if she's upset, and if so, with me or Mordaunt. I'm just saying, be careful, honey. I reach out and touch her arm. I don't want you to get hurt. Finally, she catches my hand in hers and smiles. I know. I'll be careful. She changes the subject deliberately, and as we talk, I see that half of her focus is elsewhere, reliving aural sex in a transport hub, perhaps, or dreaming up meetings yet to come. In any case, half her mind is threaded through with Alan, Alan, Alan. I suspect Lara's definition of careful won't match mine. Wednesday dawns bright and sunny, but blustery, with a bite in the wind. It's the kind of day that could go either way. Fitting. I'm early to the restaurant. The staff haven't quite finished preparing our table. I deposit myself on an uncomfortably low sofa in the entrance area, flicking through a newspaper that was laid out for just this purpose. The economy is not improving. Small businesses are going under at an alarming rate. I turn that page quickly. Kate! I look up, my automatic welcome smile pasted on. Only this isn't Gordon. It's not even a male voice. Caro! I say, with unconcealed surprise. I scramble to my feet inelegantly from the low seat. She's wearing an impeccable dark skirt suit that looks ultra-fashionable and ultra-expensive, and beautiful kitten heels. Her hair is scraped back into a perfect chignon. It's alarming how closely she fits the image I had of her in work attire. We double kiss, our cheeks barely grazing. What a surprise! Are you eating here today? For a confused moment, I wonder if Gordon has asked her to join us. No, I was just stalking you, she says breezily, then grins impishly at my expression. Relax, I was just passing. This place is a stone's throw from our office. This is true. It's why Gordon's a fan of the restaurant. I spotted you through the window. How are you? Good, thanks, you? I'm still thrown. She spotted me, and she actually chose to come in and talk to me? She flaps a hand. Good, busy, you know, same old, same old. She pauses. How did it go with the detective? Fine, I say, shrugging, though we got interrupted, so I'm meeting him again this week. What a bore for you, she says, rolling her eyes theatrically. What sort of things was he asking? Much the same as he asked everyone, I suppose. When we left, how we got home, that sort of thing. You? She nods quickly. Too quickly. Yes, that sort of thing. Lots on everyone's timings that last morning. And about the builders and the well. And when the girl was planning to leave. Her head is cocked on one side, watching and waiting. I wonder exactly which of her words she's expecting a reaction to. Severine, I say quietly. Her name was Severine. The skull grins knowingly at me. God, you do have a bee in your bonnet about that. Carol sounds amused, but somehow I don't think she is. Did he show you the CCTV footage? I shake my head. No, what footage? Do you mean Severine at the bus station? She nods. It's a joke, she says, throwing up a hand expressively. You can barely tell it's a person. Technology has moved a long way in the last decade, believe me. Thank God the bus driver remembered her getting on his bus, or things might be rather more uncomfortable for us all right now. She laughs a high, tinkling laugh, much less genuine than her earlier sly grin. I think of breaking glass. Caro, says a mild voice behind her. Gordon has arrived. Dad, she says, turning to him. This time the smile she pulls on is overly bright. Don't worry, I'm not stealing your lunch date. He rubs her arm awkwardly in lieu of a kiss. Perhaps they never kissed during the working day. I suppose it would be a little disconcerting for others around the office. Hello, Gordon, I say, smiling. We shake hands and tell each other it's a pleasure and so on. Which it actually is, at least for me. Caro explains to her father. I just popped in to tell Kate that we have a date for Seb's return. I feel a quick burst of triumph that I knew this already. She turns to me. He'll be back this week, so we'll have to have another get-together of the old gang. Maybe a restaurant this time. What do you think? I'm on my best behavior given Gordon's presence. Good idea. Then I look for something intelligent to add. Less people, which might be better for Alina, less overwhelming. Oh, I wouldn't worry about that, Caro says, unconcerned. It's not clear whether she means that Alina, whom I've never met, is not easily overwhelmed, or whether Caro simply doesn't care whether she's overwhelmed or not. I just thought it'd be a nice change since we did the drinks party thing for Tom. She glances at her watch and grimaces. Oops, back to the grindstone. I have a conference call in 5, which may well last till 5. No rest for the wicked. She rolls her eyes again. Enjoy your lunch. I look at Gordon as he watches her clip smartly out of the restaurant. Perhaps I'm expecting to see love or pride or benevolent affection. Instead, he seems... what? I can't decipher his face, though he watches for longer than feels comfortable. Then he feels my eyes upon him and turns with eyebrows raised. Well, shall we? We order and eat and talk business, but general business, not the specific business I'm chasing. Other firms and their hiring practices, the restructuring taking place in the legal industry, the mergers that are being rumoured. These are the things we discuss. I wait for Gordon to broach the subject, but our main course is swoop down, and then dessert, and then coffee, and still we're circling around. Gordon reaches for the sugar and drops a cube into his cup, paying the task more attention than it deserves. Now, I think. Now we will come to the matter at hand. So, he says. He's too precise for such a casual opening. It comes out strained. I understand from Caro that you too have been dragged into this awful French investigation. It must be rather unpleasant for you. I blink, completely thrown. Why is he bringing this up? Well, of course I'm happy to help the investigation, but rest assured, it would have no impact on my company's ability to perform under the contract if we were to be engaged. Oh, no, he interrupts me, startled. I didn't think that for a second. I look at him uncertainly. He seems a little embarrassed. Caro seems rather shaken by the whole thing, he says diffidently. I just meant to ask how you are, that's all. Oh. I watch him stirring his already stirred coffee, then realize I ought to say something more. Well, that's very kind of you. Before I can add something appropriately inane, like, I'm fine, though it's certainly unsettling, before I can reassert my professionalism without seeming callous in comparison to the rather shaken Caro, "Really?" Severine's skull begins to laugh mockingly at me, sand streaming from one eye socket. I hastily grab my coffee cup and take a sip. "On to business, then," says Gordon. He seems as keen to move on from this little interlude as I am. I agree quickly. "Yes, on to business." Business I can do. Business is what I need. I take the tube back from lunch. The stark white spreadsheet cells have been telling me that cabs are not advisable at present. In any case, I like the anonymity of London's crowded public transport system. It gives me space to think. All these people thrown into a confined space, yet nobody feels a need to talk, or to ask questions. Gordon has been asking me many questions. It's exhausting. When I get back to the office, Paul will ask what Gordon asked me. Alain Modane has been asking me different questions, and apparently he's going to keep asking. Carol has been asking me what Modane has been asking. Now I come to think of it, even Tom has been probing me about what Modane is asking. Severine doesn't ask questions. Those dark, unreflective eyes made their judgment a decade ago. Chapter 6. I'm staring at the spreadsheet again. The once clinical black numbers have developed their own presence. They cross the divide between my eyes and the computer screen and beat malevolently into my brain. Two small alterations were all that was required for the verdict to go from solvent for now to completely underwater. A change in tax law that means a hefty payment cannot be deferred, and my landlord demanding an increase in rent, which he's entitled to do at this point in the lease, though the size of the increase he's asking for is outrageous. I can fight him on it, I will fight him on it, or at least I want to fight him on it. But that will cost money the business doesn't have. He probably suspects this and is trying to squeeze me out. With more detachment, I might admire his Machiavellian streak, but right now admiration is not high on my list of feelings. Ditto detachment. I drop my head into my hands to escape the spreadsheet's toxic radiation. I could move the business location somewhere cheaper. My living room, say, or perhaps somewhere more extreme, like Croydon or Thailand. But not whilst keeping Paul, and without headhunters. Is there really any life in a headhunting firm? It was a key part of my business plan that I not be a one-woman shop. Numbers inspire confidence, though not the ones in this spreadsheet. "You okay, Kate?" asks Julie as she comes in from the outer office. I lift my head quickly and paste on a smile for her. She has her glasses in one hand and is pinching the bridge of her nose with the other. I wonder why she doesn't wear contact lenses, but not enough to ask. "Fine," I say brightly, probably too brightly. "Just a headache from too much screen time." "I'm popping out for a sandwich. Want me to grab you anything?" "No, thanks. I'll get something later and give my legs a stretch." "Okay." She glances across at Paul's empty desk, frowns briefly, then turns to go. "Julie, what's Paul's schedule today?" I ask casually. She turns back. "I'm not sure," she says awkwardly. "I thought he'd be here now." I tap my teeth with a pen, then realize she's still there, unsure of whether to leave or not. "No worries." I adopt a reassuringly cheerful tone. There's an emptiness in my stomach. It's growing and hardening. "I'll give him a call. Go on and get your lunch." "All right." All right. All right. No, nothing much is all right. But I have to go on as if it is. I sigh and lift the phone to vehemently threaten my landlord with legal action I can't afford. Alain Modane. Monsieur Modane. French detective, investigateur, OPJ, and whisperer of naughty things in the perfect ear of my best friend Lara. Alain Modane is sitting on a sofa opposite me once again, though this time we're in a comfortable corner of Starbucks rather than my living room. I have little patience today. I can feel it inside me. There's a recklessness bubbling up around the malignant tumor of worry about my business. A recklessness that's pushing me to want to cut through bullshit, to tell and hear it straight, to face the worst and know what I'm up against right now. Alain Modane is probably the last person I should be talking to in this mental condition, but I am here, and so is he. We have our coffees and we've covered the pleasantries, with no mention of Lara. So now, we begin.
Alors, says Modane, placing a manila folder on the table and flipping through his pad.
He's removed the jacket of his suit. Underneath is a slim-fitting pale blue shirt. I wonder if the skin under that shirt has the same soft grain as that on his face. I wonder if there is a tangle of chest hair under that spotless cotton. Perhaps it's his French flair that makes me consider these things, or perhaps I'm trying to see through Lara's eyes. Perhaps both. Modane's eyes have moved from his pad to my face. I force myself to focus.
I should bring you up to speed, no?
He sounds pleased with himself for the figure of speech. I glance at the folder. In films, folders like this one, this size, this shape, this color, always hold photos, gruesome murder scenes, frozen in an instant of time. Bodies at awkward angles, blood pooled beneath caved heads, open, staring eyes, death immortalized forever. I don't want to see inside this folder.
Go ahead,
I say shortly.
You are in a hurry?
He asks, his mouth quirking.
Not especially, but I do have a business to run.
I almost laugh as I hear the words from my mouth, though it's not in the least bit funny. He nods.
Of course. Well, we have found one of the builders, Monsieur Castor. He has gone through his paperwork, which states that the well was filled in on the Friday, the day before you left.
Bullshit. He looks at me.
Excuse me?
Bullshit, I say clearly.
You have six.
I shake my head abruptly. Theo. Not six. Not ever again six.
No, five people who can attest to that. The builders did the pool fence while we were there, but I don't remember them anywhere near the well. The paperwork is wrong. And the builder is lying.
The recklessness is spilling over. I struggle to stamp it down. Modane is not fazed by my combativeness.
It was a long time ago, he allows, and Monsieur Castor thinks it was his brother who actually did the work on the well. He can't remember doing it himself.
And what does the brother say?
We haven't been able to speak with him yet. He's on...
He stretches for the word.
Ah, miel. Ah, Annie Moon, oui?
I nod.
Trekking, in the Himalayas.
He makes a movement with his mouth that shows that yomping through the Himalayas is not his idea of a post-wedding treat. The folder lies there still, untouched.
Regardless, you have five people who say the well wasn't filled in. Why are you spending time on this?
One eyebrow raises a little.
It's our job to be thorough.
I press on.
What about the bus driver? He remembers Severine, right?
He looks at me, his long face displaying nothing except his habitual watchfulness.
The bus driver remembers that a young girl climbed on near the farmhouse and travelled to the station. He described her as wearing dark sunglasses, and having her hair tied in a red scarf.
I see Severine, smoking a cigarette at the end of the garden, whilst speaking rapidly on the phone. It's morning. There's still a freshness in the air that the sun will beat into submission within an hour or so. Severine's dressed in her uncompromising black bikini, a red chiffon scarf tied turban-like on her head. Her back is to me, and I can see the delicate wings of her shoulder blades moving under her skin as she gestures with her cigarette hand. It's a look that's reminiscent of the 1950s, of glamorous movie stars in oversized sunglasses lounging on the French Riviera. At that moment, I wish she was gone with an intensity I don't understand. More than that, I wish she had never been. But today, to Mordan, I murmur, "Yes, Severine." He shrugs, a curiously non-symmetrical movement that suggests his limbs are moved by a puppet master. It should be awkward, but not so on Mordan. "Perhaps." I look at him sharply. "Perhaps." He shrugs again, right shoulder then left. "Perhaps." "And the CCTV from the bus depot?" He reaches for the folder and holds it out to me.
"Regardez-vous. Please, look."
I force myself to breathe as I take the folder from him and slowly open it. Inside there is indeed a photo, a grainy image, not so much black and white as shades of grey. In among what must be the bus depot forecourt, I can make out a figure that is most likely a slender girl, perhaps with her hair tied under a scarf, or perhaps wearing some kind of cap. She appears to be standing by a large bag. I look up at Mordan, dismayed. "This is it?" He raises a couple of fingers briefly, somehow conveying, "We really tried," and "C'est la vie," in one small movement.
"That is the best picture we could get."
I look back again at the photo. Caro may have exaggerated a little. It's definitely a person. But her point is still valid. This counts for nothing. I keep looking, as if it's a digital image that needs time to resolve. But the fuzzy edges refuse to settle into a clear picture. All the while my mind loops over the same cycle. The well, the bus driver, the CCTV image. The well, the bus driver, the CCTV image. One of these things is not like the other. The well, the bus driver, the CCTV image. One of these things. I thrust the folder back at Mordan.
"Why are you still here?" I ask him abruptly. "I have a few more questions."
"Yes, but why are you still here? As in this country?" I interrupt impatiently. "I know you have to be thorough. You've been thorough. You've spoken to us all. So what's keeping you here? You have 5 people who saw her alive on Friday night. You have a bus driver who had someone exactly like her climbing on his bus on Saturday. You have a picture of that same girl at the depot with a bag. It all points pretty clearly to her being alive and well after we left." The recklessness has its head and won't be quieted. "But you're still here, and I can't figure it out, unless you're looking for an excuse to spend more time jeopardizing your career by ambushing Lara in airports." He looks away quickly and rakes a hand through his hair, then fixes wary eyes upon me, but I won't be derailed. "Or unless you actually don't believe us. Is that it? Do you actually believe that all 5 of us are lying? Are we in fact suspects?" I stop abruptly. The recklessness is spent. Mordan looks at me for a moment, his face expressionless. I have no doubt he is busy working out how best to handle me. Then his face softens.
"Miss Channing," he says gently, "this is difficult. It is always difficult. Murder is not a nice thing. No one wants to think about it too hard. It's upsetting. It's intrusive. It is frustrating. It is inconvenient. But to find whoever did this, we have to investigate. We have to ask questions."
He makes one of his elegant hand gestures, spreading his hand wide with the palm up, almost as if inviting me to place my own in it, while his lips move in a sympathetic smile.
So, s'il vous plaît, may I continue?
I hold his gaze for a moment. I can't read what is going on behind those dark, watchful eyes, but I know he's better at this than me. Better at this than almost everyone, I would think. I'm suddenly exhausted.
Go on, I say wearily. Ask your questions.
Afterward, I know I should go back to the office, but I can't face the possibility of an empty chair opposite me, or staring again at that spreadsheet. Instead, I wander aimlessly. A short walk takes me into the throngs on Regent Street. The gaggles of foreign tourists are easy to identify, with their cameras and white socks pulled up and sensible shoes. But what is everyone else doing on a shopping street in the middle of the day? Are they students? Or do they work nights? Do they work at all? I wonder what I will do when I finally call time on my company. I won't be able to go back to practicing law. I'm not sure I'd be able to convince any firm that I really wanted to, mainly because I don't. I suppose I could work for another legal recruitment firm, but my credibility will be damaged by a failed solo venture. It might take quite a while to land any position, let alone one I really want. And the truth is that the one I want is the one that's slipping away from me right now. I walk into French Connection, then walk back out again. It's too busy, and anyway, I don't really have the will or the patience to look at clothes or try anything on. I start walking again, and see my reflection moving from one window display to the next. A wraith in a dark trouser suit, slipping unnoticed past the mannequins in their forward-thinking summer attire. I could just leave, I think, get on a plane, find myself somewhere hot and dusty, where living costs a pittance, slough off my skin and take a waitressing job, or tend bar, take any job, unfettered by the pride and expectations that are built up by an Oxbridge education, built up until they wall you in. My mobile phone rings, number withheld. I hesitate, unwilling to be wrenched back into the real world, but the phone continues to chirp aggressively. I sigh and hit the answer button.
Kate Channing?
Hey, it's Tom. How are you?
Halfway to South America?
There's half a beat of silence.
Really?
He asks uncertainly.
No, not really. Just wishful thinking. Bad day.
Well, in that case, I'm taking the spot on the plane next to you. Bad day here too. He does, in fact, sound exhausted. Want to grab a drink later and commiserate? I hesitate.
I'll be dreadful company, I warn.
Yeah, me too, he says grimly. We might as well get smashed together rather than poisoning the mood of anyone else.
Jesus!
This is a far cry from the easy, steadfast Tom I'm used to. What happened to you today?
Can't talk here, he says laconically.
He can't talk in the office. Intuition strikes me. All those articles about the poor economy and downsizing in the major banks. Surely his firm wouldn't have been so stupid as to agree to relocate him from Boston to London just to fire him. Except I know banks can be exactly that stupid, and more so.
You still have a job, right?
I ask urgently.
I do. Others... not so much.
Jesus. The atmosphere must be awful on the trading floor. Well, my company is well and truly fucked, so I'm just the girl for a truly depressing night on the town. Seven at the same pub we met at before.
Done.
He pauses. Is it really fucked?
Yes, I say baldly. Only a miracle will suffice at this point.
I hear a sigh down the phone.
I'm really sorry, Kate.
His words are heartfelt. I feel a rush of warmth toward him.
I know. I am too. About your situation, I mean.
About my own, too.
Well, at least one of us still has a paycheck, he says with dark humour, which means I'm buying tonight. I can keep you fed and watered for one night at least. No argument from me. See you at 7. I disconnect, then look up to see my ghostly self hovering in front of a swimwear montage, a smile still in place from the phone call that fades as I watch. The promise of a new life, a different life, still lies tantalizingly in reach. But I have things to do before I meet Tom at 7. I head back to my office. I don't look at the spreadsheet, and I don't look at Paul's empty chair. Instead, I deal with email, and bash on determinedly with the calls I have to make. It's not so much a fighting spirit as a grim fatalism that drives me on. The few contracts we do have, we need to deliver on time and in style. Nobody should be able to say Channing Associates failed through a lack of professionalism. I've got Gordon from Hafton Weil on the phone for you, calls Julie. For a moment I consider telling her to take a message. I've been expecting a call from him, to tell me he's awarding the contract to a rival firm. I could do without the final nail in the coffin. But why delay the inevitable? Put him through, please. The phone in front of me buzzes after a moment. I find a smile to drape on my lips. Good afternoon, Gordon. How are you? Very well, thank you. Is this a good time? Absolutely. Fire away. Fire away. Not that he can really fire me since he's never actually hired me, but still, the inadvertent gallows humour amuses me. I will tell Tom that later, I think. I can already see his eyes crinkling above that unmistakable nose. I want to tell you that Opcom met last night. Opcom is the operating committee of Hafton Weil. Whatever recommendation of recruitment firm Gordon made would have had to be ratified by them, but really as a rubber stamping exercise. We've decided to award the contract to Channing Associates. He pauses, but I'm literally speechless. Subject to agreeing final documentation, of course. I sit bolt upright and find my voice. Well, thank you. I work hard to sound professional, as if contracts from firms like Hafton Weil drop in my lap every day. But inside, the tumour of worry has begun to fizz, dissolving like Alka-Seltzer in water. Yes, yes, yes! That's wonderful news. I'm delighted to hear that, as I'm sure you can imagine. Delighted, and not a little surprised. We felt it was time for some new blood. I can hear the smile in his voice. He likes it when I'm direct. And I think you and I will deal well together. I do too, I say sincerely. I'm looking forward to working with you. On that note, I've had a contract drawn up. It's fairly standard and has the terms we discussed previously. Shall I send it across now? Perfect. I pause, then add, though I should mention that we'll require the retainer fee to be paid quarterly in advance. If he agrees, Channing Associates is definitely solvent. If not, we have some creative accounting to do to get through the 3 months until the fee comes in. I find I'm holding my breath. I can't see a problem with that. Just amend the draft. Yes. The fizzing has spread to my limbs now. My legs are literally jiggling with suppressed excitement. I'll do that, and we'll get it back to you as soon as possible. We're keen to start making progress for you. Excellent. Speak again soon. Absolutely. And thank you again. This is fantastic news. I put the phone down and put both palms to my flushed cheeks for a moment, feeling my cheeks bunch in a wondering smile. I look across at the empty desk. Julie! What? She calls from the outer room. We got it! I spin in my chair exultantly. Got what? The contract! I'm on my feet now, on my way to her room, but she's moving too. We meet in the doorway. Hafton Wild! We got it! I realise I'm actually bouncing. That's fantastic! Impulsively, she grabs my hands and begins jumping with me. From the look of relief on her face, I wonder if I should have been paranoid about keeping her as well as Paul. The external door opens and Paul comes in, cursing at his disposable cup, which is dripping latte everywhere. He looks askance at Julie and me, still bouncing, our smiles as wide as our mouths can stretch. What? He dumps the leaking cup on Julie's desk and looks from me to Julie and back again, nonplussed. What? We got it, I croon. We got it, we got it, we got it. Hafton Wild, he asks urgently. Really? I nod, beaming at him. Awesome, he roars. Hafton fucking Wild, fucking awesome. Then he's slinging an arm around each of our shoulders, and all three of us are jumping together and grinning inanely. And I think, I should remember times like this, remember perfectly. I should bottle them somehow. You don't know how many of these moments you might have in your life. Chapter 7. By the time I reach the pub a few minutes after 7, I am drunk. Mostly drunk on excitement and drunk on relief, but the champagne Paul nipped out to buy and cracked open in the office has played its part too. Paul, Julie and I sat on the floor and ate posh crisps while drinking the bubbly from mugs. Paul was still shaking his head and saying at regular intervals, Hafton fucking Wild, with a broad smile and looking at me with something akin to renewed respect. And Julie was flushed and decidedly unsteady when she eventually left to catch her train. I thought, if we succeed, we will be telling the story in years to come. The anecdote of how Channing Associates celebrated their first big win. But here and now, I'm mildly tipsy, standing just inside the door of the pub once again, scanning for Tom. This time I spot him at a table. He's been here long enough to be a third of the way through a pint, with what looks like a vodka tonic waiting for me on the table. His attention is on his phone, and he's had a haircut. For a moment it throws me off balance. He looks sharper, older, other. But then he looks up and catches sight of me. He gets up to deliver his trademark hug, his face breaking into a welcoming grin. And I see... he still has freckles on his nose. He's Tom again. You look suspiciously happy, he says, releasing me and cocking his head in confusion. I nod and slip into the chair opposite him. My smile needs very little encouragement this evening. Already it's spreading across my face. That miracle I needed? It happened. We just landed a major contract. I adopt a contrite expression. I'm really sorry for not being miserable. Don't be ridiculous. That's fantastic. He waves away my apology, looking genuinely delighted for me. I'd much rather toast your success than drown my sorrows. Who did you land? Hafton Wild, I say proudly, taking the vodka tonic he slides across the table to me. With a big enough retainer to tide us over for a little while. But I'm quietly confident we'll nail the performance fee, and this bigger contract is great publicity. I wouldn't be surprised if we get a lot more interest after this. Breathe, he teases affectionately. I know, only I really thought we were fucked. The last few days catch at me. The ever-present dread, the seemingly inevitable failure looming over me. I take a deep breath and try to rid myself of the memory. But an echo of it lingers. I know, Tom says soberly. I could hear it in your voice on the phone. One contract does not a business make, but still. You have to celebrate the wins, Tom says, almost fiercely. They're important, regardless of, well, regardless. He looks away, almost as if he's embarrassed by his own vehemence. I take a sip of the vodka tonic. Well, Cheers, and thanks for this. Anyway, tell me about your dreadful day. How many did they let go?
Hundreds, he says tiredly. About 15% all told, apparently. A massacre. The thing is, I'm head of the desk now, so...
Oh, God. My hand is at my mouth. No wonder he's had such an awful day. You had to do some of the firing.
He nods bleakly. 4 guys. Well, 3 guys and a girl, actually. I barely knew them. Jesus, I'm fresh off the plane. I've barely had a chance to get to know anyone. At least I didn't have to decide who. The list was already fixed.
He takes a swallow from his pint, then stares gloomily at it for a moment, slumped in his chair with the pint at the end of his outstretched arms.
I knew there was some kind of restructuring afoot when I moved back here, but I wasn't expecting this. I only heard the details 2 days ago.
Do you think it made it easier that you didn't know them? Who you were,
well, firing, I mean. I wince a little on the key word. He shrugs. I don't know. On the one hand, yes. It's not like I know if they have families to support or anything. On the other hand, shouldn't it be personal? I mean, you work all hours for a firm, granted you expect to be paid for it. But it's an emotional thing, too. You work hard for your colleagues, you have a laugh with them, you have the odd drink with them. Don't you deserve to have someone who actually knows you shake your hand and say, God, I don't know what. Thank you, it's been a pleasure. You're really good, this is not the end for you.
He shakes his head and stares across the table at his pint again.
Something, I don't know.
Oh, Tom. There is nothing I can think of to say to that. I take a drink, and am surprised to see my glass is almost empty. We sit in brooding silence for a moment. Around us, the pub is getting busier and louder.
You know, there's a good chance at least one of them was really crap, I say eventually, with mock seriousness, or had bad breath.
The corner of his mouth tweaks upward a little.
One of the blokes was quite sweaty, he concedes, unpleasantly so. And the girl dressed like she was still a student, not jeans or anything, but ridiculous floaty skirts that were too short for a trading floor of all places, and no tights. There you go. Definitely best not to be personal, then.
He nods, a ghost of a smile in place, then pulls himself a little more upright.
You know, I used to think that we'd get wherever we got in life because of hard work. Because we deserved it,
he muses, elbows on the table.
Don't get me wrong, the hard work definitely counts. It's just that luck seems to play a much bigger part than I ever figured.
I think of Theo, of Severine. Luck, or lack thereof. It's an uncomfortable thought. Blaming luck means it could have been any of us, there but for the grace of God.
He visibly shakes himself. Anyway, another?
Let me get them.
Nope, you haven't got the money in the door yet. This is still on me.
He flashes a quick grin.
When you float Channing Associates for millions, you can pay me back. With interest.
I grin back, then watch him head toward the bar. As the bartender works his order, he checks his phone again, or perhaps it's his work BlackBerry. And for a second, the otherness is there again. Tom, but not Tom. Or a different Tom, from the one I used to know.
The evening wears on, and we move to a pizza place nearby, where Lara joins us, she and I facing Tom across the table meant for 4. We are celebrating, but not. We are commiserating, but not. It was a delicate balance in the pub, but Tom and I were managing it. Now Lara's presence is thoroughly destroying the equilibrium. Tom has become more taciturn. Lara is twitchy, and I'm too watchful, though not sober enough to interpret anything I see. And all the while Severine sits at the table too, coolly offhand, as if utterly uninterested, although I suspect she's taken in every nuance with those black eyes.
At least we're done with Modane, Tom says, out of the blue. Unless I missed the segue.
or perhaps I'm not the only one who cannot ignore Severine. Lara is peeling the label from a bottle of San Pellegrino. For a moment, her hands still. Then she takes up the task again.
You are done with him, right?
Tom persists, looking at me. I don't look at Lara.
I think so.
Did he interview Seb?
Lara asks. Now it's her turn to avoid looking sideways. She sounds brittle and self-conscious. I wonder if she already knows the answer. Tom looks at me carefully, if a little blearily.
Yep, today, he says mildly.
Lara is looking at me warily too.
It's okay, I say testily. You're allowed to mention Seb's name around me. I'm not going to freak out.
They're still looking at me.
Seriously, guys, I say in exasperation. It was a long time ago. And we'll be living in the same city, so...
I shrug, unwilling to complete the sentence.
So, what?
So, we're bound to run into each other?
So, we'll have to be civil?
So, we've both moved on? Severine turns her black eyes on mine, and for once the expression within them is entirely clear. Scorn. It jolts me.
In that case, how is Seb? Lara asks Tom.
Traitorous cow, I say, tongue in cheek. Tom gives a short bark of laughter, then frowns a little and peers at the red wine in his glass, as if uncertain what it might be.
Beer before wine makes you feel fine.
I don't know, actually, he admits. I saw him the other night, but only briefly, and Alina was with him and we couldn't really talk. He frowns again, slumping down even farther in his chair.
There's something... You know, he's not in great shape, physically I mean, which is unlike him. You know how he likes to work out. I don't know.
I see Seb, what used to be my favourite image of Seb, wearing jeans but his chest still bare. The classic Levi's model look. His beauty is heartbreaking. It's too much. He's too vital. It's impossible to look at him without an awareness that it cannot last. An awareness of mortality.
Tom is still musing. Caro's seen him too a couple of times, I think. I should ask her what she thinks.
Caro has seen him a couple of times. Severine looks at me deliberately, a secretive smirk lurking near her mouth. I search for something to say to keep up my end of the conversation.
So you haven't managed to show off your car to him yet?
Tom smiles and shakes his head. He'll be envious.
I don't know why, says Lara, still busy with the bottle. It's not like he would ever have bought it himself. He wouldn't be that original.
I look at Tom and see my own surprise registering on his face. Lara lifts her head on our silence.
What? He's not. He likes to follow the trend, not set it.
That's not entirely fair, begins Tom, then stops.
I'm still gazing at Lara. She's right. It's entirely fair. But I would never have seen it that way myself. Lara is a very smart girl, academically speaking, but she's not usually overly given to psychological analysis.
When did you get so insightful? I murmur.
She ducks her head and turns her attention to shredding a napkin. Alarm bells ring in my mind, and I feel the reverberations in my stomach.
Have you been talking about us again?
I ask urgently. She turns her head and gives me an accusatory look. I wince internally as I belatedly remember our audience. It's too late now. Tom sits up a little, aware he's missed something.
What?
He says, when neither of us speak or break our shared eye contact. After a beat or two, she concedes, rolling her eyes.
Go on then, she says, turning back to her napkin.
I turn to Tom. There is no easy way to say this, but I try to find one.
Lara has become friendly with our favourite French detective.
He's already sitting still,
but on hearing my words it seems as if even the blood in his veins has stopped moving. After a moment he says, "I see." His face blank and his voice emotionless.
"No, you don't see," says Lara, suddenly close to tears. "Nothing is happening. Nothing will happen until this bloody investigation is cleared up. And now that's going to take even longer."
She stops abruptly, then balls up the napkin and pushes it away from her, not looking at either of us.
"Why is it going to take even longer?" I ask uneasily.
She doesn't answer.
"Lara, why?" I demand more urgently.
She shakes her head, but she's still Lara. She's still the Sunshine Girl, and she can't keep a secret, either from us or from Modan.
"Because they managed to speak with the brother," she says miserably. "The Builder brother, I mean. He said he filled in the well on the Saturday. The day we left."
"But..." I'm abruptly cut off by the appearance of the waitress with our long overdue pizzas. I look at Tom in consternation as she busies herself laying them in front of us. His face is still blank, shuttered tight, presumably against revealing his feelings about Lara and Modan. Still, it crosses my mind that he doesn't seem surprised about the well, that he hasn't seemed surprised about anything, right from when he first called me.
"But," I say again.
This time I'm stopped by an infinitesimal shake of Tom's head. He cuts his eyes deliberately to Lara, whose head is down as she recovers her composure, the high spots in her cheeks gradually fading. Then he looks back, and the tiny head shake comes again. The message is clear. Not in front of Lara. Lara lifts her head, and her china blue eyes are full of anxiety.
"I shouldn't have told you that," she frets, her gaze jumping from me to Tom and back again. "Please don't tell anyone I told you that."
"Lara, it's us," I reassure soothingly. "Of course we won't tell." Tom nods in agreement, while I wonder, who would we tell? And why would Modan mind?
"Okay," she says, only slightly mollified. "It's just that, well, he was so disappointed not to be able to rule us all out. We were planning to meet up in Paris next weekend, and now..."
She looks down at her pizza, tears hovering. In a moment of alcohol-fueled clarity, I see what Lara feels like she's lost. Not just a weekend away, with all the anticipation and intoxication of clothes tearing off sex with someone new. Lara sees it as possibly the first weekend of the rest of her life. I can't remember if I felt like that with Seb. The clothes tearing off phase, I remember. But nobody gets married at university these days, or any time soon after. I always thought we were playing a long game. In France, I realized he'd stopped playing altogether.
"In that case, you'll just have to spend the weekend with us instead," I say, putting my hand on hers. "I foresee 2 days of epic frivolity, shopping on the King's Road, maybe some rom-com watching in there too, certainly a lot of decadent eating out and absolutely too much white wine." I'm rewarded by a heartfelt, if tearful, smile from Lara.
"I can cope with the rom-com, but can I skip the shopping?" asks Tom dryly.
"Nope," says Lara, gamely trying to recover her equilibrium. "You look like an American. You definitely need to update your wardrobe if you want to be a passably metrosexual male in London."
"Do I want to be a metrosexual male? What exactly is a metrosexual male?" I eat my pizza and watch them bat back and forth, the same as they've always done. Except I don't know if it's the same. They were like this before that week in France, and they were like this when they were sleeping together. But surely there must have been differences, some nuances I missed. And now, Tom has realized that Lara is in love, or at least infatuated, with someone other than himself. How can they behave just the same? Perhaps it's a pattern, a learned behaviour that one drops into by rote. Perhaps I'll learn something similar with Seb, and we'll skate lightly over the surface together whenever we meet in London. How very British. Everything's fine, just don't mention the war. As we're finishing up, Lara slips off to the bathroom. Tom watches her go, his face unreadable. I dither on whether to attack the situation head on. He's never spoken to me directly about her, in the same way that he and I don't discuss Seb. But maybe in this instance, I should extend an invitation. Are you okay? He doesn't answer. He doesn't even acknowledge the question. But as soon as she's out of earshot, he leans forward and speaks urgently in a low tone. Listen, you can't tell Lara anything. You can't talk to her about the case at all. Everything you say is going straight back to Modan. His urgency pulls me forward too, mirroring his position. I know that. Of course I know that. But really, what can I say that makes any difference? None of us have anything to hide. Except Caro with the drugs. Severine looks at me again. She is whole, but her mocking eyes are as dark as the sockets would be in her bleached white skull. He makes a sharp cutting gesture with one hand. It's not about that anymore. The police will be looking to see if any of us could have had a motive. We never met her before. Well, none of us except Theo. What kind of motive can they possibly come up with? If Lara comes out of the bathroom and we have our heads together, we will look horribly conspiratorial. I sit back in my chair. Some subset of the usual, I expect. Jealous rage, spurned lover. He's watching me closely. Spurned lover? But there wasn't any... I stare at him, at the freckles on that unbowed and unbent nose, and feel my world spinning around. There are many things he could be intending with his words. I don't know where to start to unpack his meaning. I don't get a chance to even try, because suddenly Tom starts talking. And in the States, your vacation entitlement is such an insult. I'm looking forward to some decent long holidays now I'm back. I stare at him in bemusement. He looks over my shoulder. Ah, Lara, we were just talking holidays. Any plans? Kate probably told you we were thinking about a safari. I stare at Tom as Lara reseats herself and chatters on. He glances at me, but there's nothing to read in his face. It was so smoothly done. I would never have guessed he was capable of such casual duplicity. Once again, he is other. Tom, but not Tom. I wonder, is everyone not who I thought? Maybe nobody ever really knows anyone. And then I wonder, in that case, does anyone know me? Chapter 8. I call Tom the next morning. It's not the first thing I do when I wake up, and I didn't wake early. In fact, it's barely still morning when I finally allow myself to pick up the phone. Kate, he says after a couple of rings. His voice is sleepy and deeper, more gravelly than usual. Sorry, did I wake you? I'm not the least bit sorry. At this time of day, I feel well within my rights to wake anyone. No, I've already been to the gym. Maybe the alcohol is responsible for the gravel in his voice then. I hear him yawn. I figured you'd call. Want to come over? I'll throw something together for lunch. It's both a relief not to have to ask to see him, and embarrassing to have him find me so predictable. Done. I glance at my watch and perform the mental maths. I can be there around 12:30 if that works for you. Perfect. See you then. The tube is full of the weekend crush. Tourists and families and self-consciously cool teens, all in pairs or groups, as if nobody travels alone on a Saturday or Sunday. I turn my head to stare out of the window. This part of the tube runs through a series of tunnels and open-air sections. I see overgrown leafy embankments interspersed with the bleached-out reflection of the carriage. Neither gives away much about London. I'm thinking of Tom's words.